know, we had the NCI, National Cancer Institute, step up. We had the Journal of the American Medical Association. They stepped up. Sarah Parker Pope wrote a story, excellent story, she wrote for the New York Times, July 29, in 2013. And when I realized, I said, you know, today is the 7th anniversary of when they announced that 91% of cancer is not cancer, and it's been crickets. Dr. Warburg had learned this in the 1930s. I think they gave him the Nobel Peace Prize in 1931 for it, that cancer cells can only be found in acidic, low oxygen environments. And the first thing that we're saying is, look, until your body starts to act like it's hosting a cancerous adaptation, don't do anything. If you do not have inflammation and your temperatures are not elevated, you don't have cancer. You cannot have cancer. Cancer is only hot, and hotter, hotter, hotter. Everything about cancer can be clearly seen by temperature. I just want them all to know that God made us better than this. And don't be afraid. Do not fear.
If you have not been looking at C60 as a means to significantly improve your health and your immunities, you should be. Here's why. First, a strong and healthy immune system is your body's first defense. And for those with a strong immune system, your body will adequately fight illnesses without medical intervention. Second, C60 is safe. As long as you're taking a high quality C60 with no added fillers or solvents. Third, C60 is the best means of removing free radicals from your body that exist. It's at least 200 times better at this function than vitamin C and any other antioxidant. This is the magic. When you free up your body's resources from fighting free radicals, they then can focus their attention on healing. Every person has different needs, but the magic begins when your body can start to heal. So now it becomes clear you need the best free radical fighter that exists, and that is C60 with black seed oil and curcumin. Go to sarahwestall.com/shop and learn more about why this formula is so powerful. Also available by diffuser with ultra refined C60 oil to safely get directly into your lungs. It's also the best way to help your family pets by just being in the same room. Be sure to read the research and, of course, use the current coupons to save money when you buy. Patrons also receive a 10% discount. You can find that code at patreon.com/sarahwestall. Remember, keeping you and your family safe is the most important thing you can do. Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today's show, we are welcoming Dr. Jeff Preistupa. Dr. Jeff is the Research Director for Women's Against Breast Cancer and the Human Patient Association. He is on a mission to inform women that 91% of diagnosed breast cancer is not cancer. Considering breast cancer is the number one cancer in women, it is critical this information is widely known by medical professionals and by patients. Unfortunately, it isn't. Dr. Jeff is going to explain that the vast majority of misdiagnosed cancer is actually calcification. Calcification is dead matter and can never turn into cancer. This information was originally published in 2013 by the National Cancer Institute, the Journal of the American Medical Association, and even the New York Times did a story on it, but then it was all buried. I have links to the studies on my website at sarahwestall.com. You know, you can see this two ways. You can see this as a very traumatic thing to learn about, or something that's very positive for humanity. I gotta see this as a glass half full situation, because just learning that 91% of breast cancer is not cancer is a huge step forward. We don't have to give them alternative treatments and fight the establishment. We just need to educate people that it's really not cancer. So this is good news. We just gotta spread the good news, the truth, so that people know what it is. And Dr. Jeff is going to go through and explain what this all means. And it's why we fight right now to change our circumstances. Information like this needs to get out to the people so that we can heal. There's so much that we're fighting, but this is a big reason why we fight. And I want to thank people who have personally donated to the sheriff fund. There has been checks that have been coming in as well, which are not showing up on when you go to the donation page. So it looks like we've received less than we really have, but we still are really short on the funds that we need. Our goal is to get 1/3 of the sheriffs in this country educated on their oath of office to protect us against mass vaccinations, from our gun grab, from anything that isn't supported in our Constitution and our rights. As you may know, Australia's prime minister now was saying that they're going to do mass force vaccinations. The rhetoric is ramping up big time. The sheriffs are our last stand against protecting us against that kind of tyranny, and they don't speak for anyone except the voters, so they can protect us. So if you haven't donated yet, please do that. And you can go to sheriffffund.com. And if you get an error, you should not be getting an error. And you look for the link below where I have, it's this long thing at Snowball that you go to donate. So we've created an alias, sheriffffund.com, to make it easier for people. But again, if you get an error, look for the longer link. You can also go to the cspoa.org and you can donate directly to them as well. It doesn't show up in the totals, but it at least they get the money. It's all going to the same account. And I also want to thank my patrons for supporting me during this time. My account's been demonetized. There's been so many layoffs, so many people struggling. You know, of course, the support of my affiliates is always appreciated, but people are struggling. I don't have the same support of my affiliates that we need. So my patrons are hanging in there. So thank you so much. And of course, you can always go and support my affiliates, which supports the show as well, at sarahwestell.com under shop. And if you've not signed up for my newsletter yet, please, please pause the show. Go to my website and sign up for my newsletter. That is really important. I don't know what's going to happen with censorship. Every day someone else is shut down. So to keep the channels open, please sign up for my newsletter. And thanks everybody for all the support again. And let's get into this really important interview with Dr. Jeff now.
Hi, Dr. Jeff. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Sarah. It's great to be with you today.
Well, I'm really glad that you reached out to me and you're persistent, because you have an incredible story. And I guess, you know, with everything going on, I don't think people will be so surprised that this is going on, what you're going to be talking about today. But I think it's part of the truth trauma. We have to shed light on things so that we can expose it, get over it, fix it, and become a healthier society. But before we get into this crazy topic of breast cancer, can you tell us your background? Because your background is very impressive.
The doctor that I am today, we can thank or blame Dr. John Maloney in Springfield, Mass. He was my grandparents' doctor when he first began the practice. And they were from, my grandfather was Pennsylvania Dutch. And so Dr. Maloney really probably couldn't practice today because he didn't believe in medicine. And so Dr. Maloney taught me about my body as a youngster, how it could heal, and it didn't need anything, it was strong. And so I kind of grew up wanting to be a medical doctor like Dr. John Maloney from Springfield, Massachusetts, because he was just such a wonderful, caring, old-style doctor. We didn't go from his office to the pharmacy. We went from his office to maybe get some honey and some baking soda, things like that around the house. And so I practice healthcare like Dr. John Maloney taught me growing up in Springfield, Mass. And so that's why I always wanted to be a medical doctor, and was quite discouraged later on when I had to change career paths.
Well, but let's talk about where you worked. You worked at Sloan Kettering, which is a prestigious cancer institute, right? And you started learning some truths while you were there. Talk about your experience.
I'd love to. I had the dream job, Sarah. When I got out of college, I had decided not to go into professional photography, that I would pursue medicine as my primary interest. And so I went and I got a fantastic job in the Laboratory of Human Genetics in the New York Blood Center on East 67th Street, there between 1st and 2nd Avenue, working with Dr. James German in the Laboratory of Human Genetics, and I began to do tissue culture, and I loved it. I had a fantastic job. I would biopsy the patient and go start to cell cultures, blood cultures, skin cultures, as well as growing other kinds of hybrid cells, HeLa cells, cancer cells, all kinds of different cells that were under in culture in the laboratory. So that was my introduction. On my way to medical school, working for a while in a great laboratory, genetics was a rather new field then. This was the mid-70s. And so I had a dream job. I had a high-powered microscope. And what I share with our audience, I'm going to tell you, I saw it with my own eyes. I grew these cells day in and day out. I subcultured them. I froze them. I thawed them. I sent them around the world. So when I talk about cells or I talk about health, I know it at the cell level.
And then there's a point where you...
I could never get away from that perspective, Sarah. Well, because I knew that at the absolute level of health, that you know, I would I would grow these cells, and I had just taken them out of people. And I knew where they had come from, and I've got a part of them in a small glass jar. And I admit, I would talk to the cells. And I would carry on as if I'm Mr. Smith or Mr. Schwartz or, you know, Mr. Bloom or whoever they were, because I had a, you know, I mean, I had taken these cells out of people who were still outside walking around on the streets in different places in the world. It was, you know, kind of a little weird. But anyway, the cells, when I learned what it takes to keep cells healthy, I thought, well, that's it. If we can keep our cells healthy, well, then we'll keep our organs, glands, and tissues healthy. And if we keep our cells healthy and our cells have enough power in them and enough food to do their work, well, then the organ, glands, and tissues will have enough power and energy to do their work. And if the cells are healthy, the organs, glands, and tissues are healthy, and the whole body, mind, and spirit would be healthy.
Yeah. So you started realizing that preventative medicine was the most important thing to do. But when you were at Sloan Kettering and you were doing cancer research amongst other things, what did you realize about cancer that changed your mind about medicine?
All right. So that's a very good question. And that question is, why do some cells begin to display cancerous behavior? Why do some cells? And I provoked cells into displaying cancerous behavior in the lab. We can talk about that. I made them act cancerously by what I did to them. And what became apparent to me is that cancer is a cellular adaptation. And Dr. Warburg, when I began to learn, do more research on it, Dr. Warburg had learned this in the 1930s. I think they gave him the Nobel Peace Prize in 1931 for it, that cancer cells can only be found in acidic, low oxygen environments. And we've known that, and yet we've never really taken advantage of Dr. Warburg's findings and included his particular recommendations into our cancer paradigms, into our cancer protocols. Like, we gave him the Nobel Prize and said, now go sit over there and be quiet, and never utilize his findings, his incredible findings on oxygenation, for example.
And why? Why do you, because what, with your, let's jump into this now. You're saying that 91% of breast cancer is not cancer. And how does that relate to your, I mean, this is something you learned, and it really, did you learn this later, or did you start realizing that early on that there was something seriously wrong?
Well, it took me seriously. When I left Sloan Kettering, I thought I was done with it. I thought, you know, washed my hands. I just had given it an excellent 3-year. And I said, I love this job. It was a great job. I was enjoying the, if you will, academic environment in New York City, intellectually challenging. Some of the greatest minds gathered there. But I realized that they did not have a sincere desire to cure cancer. They were not motivated to rid oneself of the task of having to deal with cancer on a continual basis. And that's a little bit of part of the story here, but from a very strong influence of my father, my dad taught me to fix it. My dad was a brilliant man, and he liked to fix things, and he taught me that you only get that if you don't fix it the first time, that you begin to lose money. That Jeff, when you go fix something, fix it the first time you're there, because if you have to go back, you're going to work for nothing. If you have to go back again, you're now losing money. You won't be in business. So I got a fix it attitude from my father, as well as Dr. Maloney, who thought that you help people get rid of their healthcare problems.
Preventative doesn't get people coming back for more and more. And cancer is a lot of money to treat. And so they want to treat that. And if you can have women that have 91% breast cancer versus, or, you know, if you get 91% extra women with breast cancer who don't have breast cancer, think of the money that is. I do you think that all of those mis we're going to get into this misdiagnosed thing and where it comes from, and the fact that the establishment, there was very prestigious journalists trying to get this information out there, and that was it was buried. But do you think that all people involved understand this, or do you think there's a lot of well-intentioned people, including doctors, who are misdiagnosing and just don't realize it?
Oh, Sarah, it's the latter case. My fellow practitioners, and I found this universally true. I don't care what kind of doctor they are. I don't care what kind of practitioner they are. The midwives, everyone who's working in healing is doing so, and from, I believe, a good heart. We have many, say, sometimes administrators who get a little more carried away with carrying a clipboard and managing people instead of patients or departments, and they may not have the same motivations, but the nurses are the heroes in all of healthcare. They care tremendously, and I would say that most doctors are doing the very best they can within the limitations that are imposed on them by the standard of care.
So now, where is this greed or this incredible corruption coming from? And maybe it's not, maybe it's just mass ignorance, but where, and I don't know, I have a hard time believing that everybody's this ignorant, but where is it coming from? The mandates.
Usually, when we are on the pursuit of truth and looking for understanding, I have always found the best path to follow is the money trail. Will lead you to understanding more often than any other pathway on your attempt to learn. If we would just step aside for a second and ask ourselves a pretty obvious question: do we think that the cancer industry can afford economically, financially, a cure? Do we think that the cancer industry, as it is, Morton Anderson, all of it, from the pink, all of it, do you think that they would commit financial suicide by finding a cure?
Well, no, but I never thought until you started talking to me that they would go as far as diagnosing cancer that's not cancer either. We can understand that you wouldn't find a cure on purpose, but to create a disease that's not there is a step farther than I thought they would take.
I would like to agree with you on that. If I could look at any other instance in healthcare where they behave properly upon finding that it really wasn't the best protocol, for example. For example, when they found out that fluoride is not effective in tooth decay prevention, they could have taken it out of the public water since there's no other reason for it being there. And when we know that the drop in dental caries around the world, World Health Organization showed that it wasn't fluoride that did it. Well, geez, what was it then? And if we can prove it, if we know that it wasn't fluoride, well, no one would say, well, then why is it in the water then? And I don't know the answer to that.
Well, it's just having good nutrition.
I don't even see why there's not even a big movement to take fluoride out of the water.
Well, there is a movement, but that's another group being censored. But let's talk about, the fact that you don't even know there's a big movement is sad, because there is a, people are just trying so hard to get the information out, and they're just being shut down every which way. And it's really sad because people should be able to learn the truth on different on things and figure out really what's going on. But let's talk about this breast cancer stuff, because you know they shouldn't be able to. We're just going to talk about what these prestigious journals posted themselves and did themselves. And so we don't,
okay.
We're not going to be talking about your own research. Well, and the thing is, we're not going to be talking about you just as you, we're going to be talking about their research and information that's out there. And the reason I say this is because this should not be censored, and YouTube and all the powers that be do not censor this, because this is information where we're just repeating what journals and other people have said. So can you start by talking about the fact that 91% of breast cancer is not cancer, and where this information started to be published, and what they said about it?
Yes. The studies were originally published. The National Cancer Institute came together with a group. They brought together an excellent group of doctors. And they began to do some review, and they found that they should not be using the word carcinoma in reference to cancer, because the use of the term carcinoma it creates fear and doubt, and it can lead to what they're calling overdiagnosis. And the overdiagnosis, they're claiming, also will lead to overtreatment. The National Cancer Institute, Sarah, I'm pretty sure had some pressure when it came time to publish their findings. I'm sure they had some pushback, but they did. They published and presented it, and it was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, NCI, 2013. So the Journal of the American Medical Association also, I'm sure, had some pressure to sit on this report, but they did. The Journal of the American Medical Association also stepped up and published, and they found that the word carcinoma should be changed because the overtreatment was leading to disfiguring surgery, unnecessary operations that were the result of overdiagnosis. So we had the NCI, National Cancer Institute, step up. We had the Journal of the American Medical Association. They stepped up. Sarah Parker Pope wrote a story, excellent story, she wrote for the New York Times. And that's kind of what prompted this. Is it was July 29 in 2013. And when I realized, I said, you know, today is the 7th anniversary of when they announced that 91% of cancer is not cancer, and it's been crickets.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
It's been absolute crickets since then, and so
well they buried it
they well
they buried it right, because you don't see any of that anymore.
I'm giving these people credit for having the courage to go ahead and publish, and the forces that were at trying to keep them from publishing were unsuccessful, but they were successful at burying the body of information where I guess it's not been found. And so I am, and with the help of several friends, we've come together, we'll talk about this more. But we said, you know what, I guess this is going to have to be something that the patients do on their own. We're going to have to go grassroots. We're going to have to go consumer rights, patient rights. We're going to have to take this knowledge and share it ourselves and just see what we can do. And so we created an informational, educational campaign. That's all. We're just telling people, and we're relying on each other to share the word, starting off with 91% of diagnosed cancers misdiagnosed, in that carcinoma is not cancer, and DCIS, let's break this down because we're going to get into terms that that people have heard, ductal carcinoma, there's that word they don't want us to use, ductal carcinoma in situ, which just means ductal calcification in the body, in the tubes, situ is just the body. So what they really have is ductal calcification, and they label that as carcinoma. That accounts for 80% of breast cancer, DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ. Lobular carcinoma in situ is where the a little cluster of cells in a lobe will begin to be calcified, and they'll call that lobular carcinoma in situ, LCIS. That's 11% of all breast cancer.
Yep.
So we have 80% DCIS, 11% LCIS, that's 91% of carcinoma of the breast is not cancer. It's calcification.
And then the rest is true cancer. The rest is true cancer. The calcification, now let's compare the difference between what it means to have calcification and not calcification. What is that?
Right.
I have a chart here that you sent me, and I'll put that up.
Oh, good.
What the difference is between calcification and cancer. Can you talk about that?
Yes, it's very clear when you break it down and look at that chart. We have we just put an equal column on the right-hand column says cancer. Over the left-hand column, it says calcification. And we're just going through and showing the differences between the two procedures. The primary one is that cancer is a cellular response, and that calcification is molecular. Cancer is biology. It's got to do with living things, and calcification's chemistry. It's dead. As we go down that list, we see that the cancer cells are alive. You know, calcification's dead. Cancer's organic. The chemistry of the calcification is mostly inorganic. So as we look at the major factors between cancer and calcification, the two at the top are the most important, Sarah. That's inflammation in angiogenesis.
Well, why, when they do a biopsy, can't they tell the difference?
Well, because they're not checking for that. You see, we are supposedly scanning the breast for to early detection. But what happens is that the method used, an X-ray mammogram, is not sensitive to any water densities. The X-ray radiation is used to detect calcium. And I had an X-ray machine in my practice for 35 years. And as a photographer, I love X-rays. I mean, please get me the X-ray. I want to see it. But that's bone. And you can see bone very well with X-ray. But cancer is a water cellular thing, and you can't see it. You can't really see cancer on any image.
Wouldn't they biopsy that tissue?
Well, what they see is they say, well, Sarah, we saw in your mammogram, we saw here we have some spiculation. We see we have some calcification here, and they'll describe the calcification. And they say, we're going to take some cells. Now, wait a minute. Why? Why are you taking cells based on calcification? I don't find any basis for that. But on the wall, on the chart, it says that between 15 and 50% of the time, the calcification is going to turn into cancer.
And that's just wrong.
It's impossible for a calcium molecule to become alive. It can't Frankenstein itself and somehow grow a cell membrane, a double wall cell membrane around itself, and somehow get some mitochondria in there and some other organelles and the endoplasmic reticulum. And
So basically, if they biopsy, it doesn't matter because they have themselves convinced that this is going to 50% of the time, or up to 50% of the time, it will turn into cancer. So no matter what, if you even in under the cells and you do a biopsy, even if it shows you clearly that it's calcification, they still recommend doing something because 50% of the time it will turn into cancer.
When they go and do the biopsy, you see they're following what's known as the standard of care. The standard of care is written for the institution, the clinic, doctor's office, whoever it is. The standard of care is written as a defensive document to protect against liability from being sued. And the standard of care is in place to protect the clinic to protect the hospital, to protect the doctor. And so what happens to the patient is they the care from the standard of care. The doctors aren't treating the patients anymore. The lawyers are, by writing the standard of care. When you go see the doctor, you don't get what you need. You get what you get when you got what you got. And you're one of those, like one of those people, and they put the diagnosis on you, and here comes the stuff. It's not for you. It's for people like you. And that's what happens in cancer. They don't treat individual patients. They treat conditions. And you get what is given to those who got what they say you got. And that is, first of all, with a diagnosis with an oma on it, a carcinoma. We are recommending, just a simple recommendation, that the diagnosing of that simply reflect the finding so that ductal calcification in situ and lobular calcification in situ are simply called that. Call it what it is. When you look at the x-ray in porta.
Well, and they stop using calcification, the standard of care for calcification being the same treatment as cancer, and you would stop that altogether.
Well, what we would do is we would back up a little bit and we would take a look at the difference between what's really cancer and what's not. And we would simply then act according to what is cancer and act according to what we know is not cancer. And that's why it is as simple as we are teaching. It's as simple as A, B, C. 1, 2, 3, do, re, mi. If it's not hot, then it cannot be.
If it's not alive.
Cancer.
So, okay, so what are you doing? You have a group, grassroots group that are going out there and trying to educate women on this because it's pretty cruel to put women through this if they don't have cancer. I mean, I've seen some of my friends who've had chemotherapy and all these things. It's just a cruel process if they really didn't have cancer. I mean, how do they relate? Before you get into your thing, I have one more question. How do they relate the stages of cancer if it's just calcification? Because somebody might have a stage 4. You have a stage 4. Well, what's a stage 4 if it's calcification? How do they do that? Or stage 3 or 2 or whatever?
Sarah, it's staging. It's. I find it not that helpful, really. I don't think that it really is educational or informative or something that we can use very well. I think that the cellular basis of what's happening, I think staging would best be done with temperature. And I think that if you want to stage it accurately, use temperature and talk about how much hotter it's getting compared to last time. I think if we want to stage properly, we would use temperature for that.
Yeah, so we're just not using the right paradigms. And so it just ends up being an inaccurate measure of what really is going on.
Yes, it's a logical question. I mean, where am I along this progression? But I don't find that it's really very helpful because we're not using those markers in a helpful guiding way that has us change the treatment, for example. It's not like, well, let's try vitamin C treatment now. We just keep on doing the same things over and over again, no matter what the staging information might indicate.
Oh, that makes sense.
So I don't find it that helpful. I think if we're going to stage, we should use temperature.
That makes sense. Okay.
1 out of 5 lesions, 1 out of 5 lumps, bumps, cysts, fibroids will go on to displaying cancerous behavior. 1 in 5. 4 out of 5 are benign or normal. Lumps, bumps, cysts, fibroids, calcification, normal. 4 out of 5 normal, 80%, 20%, 1 out of 5 going on to display cancerous behavior. Now, the thing about what's real cancer, and if this is you, we've got to deal with it. Please, I am not a cancer denier. I am not. Cancer is a very real condition, and it must be dealt with. And so, please, I'm not saying that we ignore it. Don't know. I'm simply pointing out that there is a very effective way for us to separate the false positive cancer diagnosis from the normal benign lesion. And that's what I'm advocating. I just want to help I want to save women who do not have cancer, asterisk, from being treated as if they did.
Okay, well then let's go through this because I still want to see how they can put a level 1 through 5 on something that's calcification.
When cancer strikes, it begins with inflammation, like most diseases do. It begins with inflammation at the cell level. If you will, a little fire starts at the cell level and begins to, if the conditions are such that you fuel it, and the conditions are such, as Dr. Warburg talked about, if, in effect, we've put up a cancer cell bird feeder somewhere, whether it's acidic, low oxygen, et cetera, there might be a lot of estrogen, sugar. We've hung up the cancer cell's food for them, and we put up a cancer bird feeder. That's all that happens when the cancer cells come to dine somewhere in a compartment in our body. Research now is showing it begins in the mouth, actually, and goes down the lymphatics in the neck and into the breasts. That actually breast cancer starts in the mouth. We're working with dentists. What an interesting new role for the dentist to play in breast cancer prevention, because it starts around the mouth. As Dr. Dowling says, it stays on the same side. It won't even cross over.
Oh, okay.
So if you've got lesions in your mouth that are inflamed, and it's going to continue now to continue growing within you, you're going to see it go down the same side of your neck into the breast and begin to form the kind of growth areas that are going to, again, be inflamed. Cancer starts hot with a lightning strike of inflammation. And cancer then is supported by a growing blood supply called angiogenesis. Imagine, Sarah, that you're looking at your hand, right? And as you're looking at your hand, suddenly it sprouts 5 more fingers that are fatter. That's angiogenesis. Your blood supply does that. And that's what must take place in order for cancer to grow. Angiogenic switch. And it is what is known to be the difference between what is really going to be cancer and what isn't. If it doesn't get angiogenesis, if it doesn't get the new blood supply, the tumor is limited in its growth to 1 or 2 millimeters because the surface area limits it. But it, with the new blood supply going inside and creating increased nutrient flow, that's what can fuel the cancer growth that defines cancer. They call it the uncontrolled proliferation of cells. Cells growing at an uncontrolled rate is the definition of what we call real cancer. The fake cancer is not that. It's not hot. It's simply not hot. And so we know that the body's not reacting to that in a cancerous fashion.
We have cancer cells all the time in our body that our body's constantly getting rid of, correct?
Yes, because our body grows cancer cells, because the cancer cells that we grow don't come from some alien somewhere that suddenly comes in and spritzes us with cancer cells. When we grow cancer cells, those are our own cells. Those cells are my cancer cells, your cancer cells. They're behaving differently because they're a cancer cell, but make no mistake about it. Those are your cells. And you know what? Your immune system knows it, and that's why it won't attack them.
So, okay, so now answer my question on how they can take something that is just calcification or is cancerous cells but isn't hot, it's not acting cancerous. How do they get to a point where they can measure something at like a 3 or 4 when it's not?
They are taking a process which is degrading the cells in the middle of what they are calling a necrotic center. It's where the cells in that pussy area in the middle have died because, Dr. Warburg said, there's no oxygen there, no nutrients there, and everything you've got is fueling fueling anaerobic respiration. Now, that just means breathing without air or with less air. But we have aerobics, or aerobic respiration, how we normally breathe aerobically. And we can also have the ability to breathe anaerobically. I mean, certain cells have the ability to also, our cells can't, our mammalian cells can't. But yet we have cells within the potential in our bone marrow to be able to breathe anaerobically when and if necessary. Here's the surprising thing. This really surprised me and put my mind at rest. For the longest time, I couldn't understand how cancer could be a natural thing. How could cancer be a part of what's going on around us when we look at it seems so perfect in many ways? How could cancer, and especially breast cancer, attacking the very breasts that nourish our young, it seemed like such a betrayal. But the fact is that everyone starts out getting cancer, forming a tumor between themselves and their mother called the placenta. And that's the first time we get cancer, is this placenta burrows into mom, cancerously attacking and then establishing a blood supply, lymph supply, arteries, veins, lymph, and hooking up the plumbing and sharing with that. And that is the first time we get cancer. And so if we didn't get cancer the first time, no life would exist. And what happens the second time is, again, it's a little bit longer story, but it's those same cells getting called up to get back into action and believing that they have a job to do again because of the chemical signaling. And we haven't even talked about toxicity yet, which is a whole reason that cancer is happening to us in our population. Toxicity has replaced infection. And so these things are causing cancerous environments, like putting up the cancer bird feeder. And the only reason that cancer cells go where cancer cells go is for the same reason that the goose is in the cornfield in the fall, the mouse is in the grain, the rat's in the dump. You know, everything's eating. It isn't so much that we have to kill cancer. Take down the bird feeder. Stop hosting cancer parties. Don't invite them over instead of trying to kill everybody when they show up at your party.
And I think on my show, we've covered so many things that, you know, show that cancer's growing because of the everything that we're bombarded by. So we don't have to necessarily tell everybody, you know, because I would like them to follow you, get more information, and they can follow your organization. But how, I still want my question, and then I want to get into how they can get more information on your organization. How do they diagnose something that is really just calcification and then give it a 1 to 5 level? It would always be at 1, I would think. Why would they, it hasn't turned into cancer yet. You know, if it has 50% chance of it, it's still at 1. How could they give it a 1 to 5 level? You know, you're in stage 3 kind of thing.
Yeah. The different stages are based on the appearance of the lesions and some of the cells that they're taking in biopsy. The biopsy of cells itself, we could talk for a long time about that because I had to do that in the lab as well. And so I'm familiar with, you know, cell preparation on a slide. But when you do that, you aren't really able to distinguish, for example, whether that cell is, what really type of cell it is, because oftentimes the cells are going to be, when you're culturing a cell outside of its in vitro environment in the body, and you begin to see these cells growing in monolayers in culture, it is difficult to distinguish the defining characteristics of where they might be in a degenerative process. So they will take a look at, say, well, the shape of this lesion, the amount of dead cell products, the dead cell products that they're going to measure.
Tissue, maybe the amount of cells.
Well, I'm drawing a bit, yep. blank a little bit about the biochemistry of that aspect. So, but they do it by appearance. And they're looking at the continued breakdown of the tissue and the structure around the tissue as this tumor is growing. And so that is done by a process of amount of destruction by the age of the process. How they're taking a look at how long the fire, if you will, has been burning, and they're taking a look at the amount of destruction so far, and they're saying, well, it's invaded this, it's now overlying, it's exceeded these borders here, it's transgressed beyond this initial thing, and the rate at which it's expanding, that might be tumor growth, one of those characteristics. The size of the tumor might be one of those things.
Is it possible for them to say it's a stage 3 or 4 or 5 when it's really just calcification?
The conflict doesn't really arise from there. The conflict is arising from the perspective of what is happening to the body at the cell level. The medical profession, who again are doing what's following the standard of care, are going to apply chemo, radiation, and probably employ tamoxifen. And the first thing that we're saying is, look, until your body starts to act like it's hosting a cancerous adaptation, don't do anything. That when you go, if you find something in your breast, or if you get a thermogram, or if you get, no matter what happens, if what you've got does not have inflammation, the lightning blast of cell stress, inflammation, flame within, if you do not have inflammation and your temperatures are not elevated, you don't have cancer. You cannot have cancer. Cancer is only hot, and hotter, hotter, hotter. Everything about cancer can be clearly seen by temperature. It starts hot and grows hotter, 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 hotter. If we would look to controlling temperature at the cell level, it'll be years before it would grow into an organ, gland, or tissue lesion. The good news is that we have 6 or 7 or so years from when inflammation strikes to where we can say, wow, we better do something about this cancer. And the really good news that we have to share with everybody in Women Against Breast Cancer, WABC, and we need help with this organization. Believe me, we do. We're just starting off, and it's an educational effort. Please help us if you have a heart to. We'll talk more about that later. But the Women Against Breast Cancer are simply sharing the word with each other. 91% of breast cancer is misdiagnosed. If you've been told you have DCIS, 80%, or LCIS, 11%, whoa, time out. Stop right there. Hold it. You don't have cancer. And what you have is calcification. And you certainly have time to learn what that is. And we should deal with that. If there's something going on in our box, well, let's deal with that. Let's not have that going. There's a reason for that. There's a reason for the calcification. Let's deal with that. But the most important thing right now is that 7 years ago, they told the world that this calcification is not cancer, that it leads to overdiagnosis and overtreatment. And we've got people that stepped up. These organizations would not have, maybe today, but they did. The NCI, JAMA, New York Times, they all stepped up and published. And I have to applaud them for that. But it's been crickets since. And all we want to do right now is tell everybody anything regarding breast cancer. Hold it. Time out. Check it out. Slow down a little bit. Whoa. It's not like that. Cancer is not the disease that everyone has claimed it to be. It's not. It is a dangerous thing. Yes, it is. But it's not the monster that is killing women at the rate that they're being told, scared into.
Well, let's talk about your organization,
okay.
Women Against Breast Cancer. Now, do you have a lot of educational materials on that website that people can go to and learn about this?
I have all the stuff that I've had on another website that needs to be hosted. You see, what it is, I thought I was going to retire, which I retired for an afternoon and then realized I shouldn't have done that. And so I've been doing things with a limited budget here to get some of these things up and going. We have a whole body of research we have to do from the Women Against Breast Cancer. We want to do a study and we want to measure exactly. The stats within the cancer industry say that between 15 and 50% of DCIS and LCIS go on to forming cancer. 15 to 50. That's, you know, 15 out of 100 to 1 in 2.
It's wrong.
And so what we're saying, okay, we're going to measure it. We're going to find out. We're going to measure it. We're going to see exactly how often DCIS or LCIS turn into cancer. We're going to do the study ourselves. We're going to measure it.
Well, because the Cancer Institute and all the ones that everybody's putting money to, nonprofits, are not doing this work. Right. And so you guys are going to do it and get people the right information and get this out to the people, get the studies done, get the information on your website. Now, you said that you needed help with this. What kind of help do you need from people?
Sarah, the most help that we need from people is what you're doing for us this afternoon here with this interview. What you sharing the word with your audience is going to be such a great start. But people, as you're listening, if you got a heart for this, if you want to put, you know, if you're good with a computer and want to share and blog and help us with this, it's just going to be like if you're an academic, we want to get some billboards up if we can. All I'm going to say is 91% of breast cancer is misdiagnosed. WABC, you know, .org. Find out for yourself. We reserve the name womenagainstbreastcancer.com. We also have WABC.org. But I started all this again. We launched it just past July 4th. And so we're getting everything together. I've got a lot of material, a lot of stuff I sent you. We can put together that material. I did send you some things that you could, we can post, some things that people can download. So I'd be glad to share that. My fiance, April, is finishing up her job. She's going to come and dedicate herself full time to doing this. She'll be great at it. It'll be a big help.
Okay. Well, how can they reach you? How can they reach you to be able to help? Is there a contact information on the website?
I don't know if I have a placeholder there or not yet. I don't think I do. I'm on Facebook. We have the,
Okay, give us your contact here, or I can put what I can do. Hold on. What I can do is I'll put it in the show notes, what your contact information is. And so if anybody wants to get hold of you and help you with this cause, you can just, they can contact you by looking. It'll be on my website or in the show notes, depending on where you're looking at this. And they can get hold of you that way. How does that sound?
That sounds perfect.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Dr. Jeff, for joining us today. I really appreciate you taking this on. I know it's a challenge. And if we don't work hard at doing things that are difficult, where we're going to have extreme pushback, then our life isn't worth living, I don't think. We need to change this for the better for everyone.
I especially, Sarah, think that there's a lot of women out there who are also spiritual, whether it's religious-based. But I just want them all to know that God made us better than this. And don't be afraid. Do not fear. Really, don't be in fear. And that's the major thing, is that I want people to know that God didn't do this. This is not as bad as it seems, and that hopefully the truth will prevail, and the light can shine through this darkness right now, because we've been lied to, and it's time for the truth to come out.
Well, thank you so much. I'm so glad that you joined us today.
Thank you again, Sarah. Thank you. God bless.